Welcome to the Directing Animation Live cast with Scott Weiser. Now that I'm done directing the development and first episode of the second series of Space Station Animation, I'm joining up with Steamroller Animation to push the boundaries of the art form. Thanks to the support of so many of you, I'm continually developing more than 10 dynamic feature film pitches while mastering the art of telling deeply meaningful stories. Our guest today has a fun story. We actually had a panel a couple weeks ago at the Salt Lake Animation Expo, and we had Chris Wall as a virtual guest, but a lot of technical difficulties made it so he could hardly speak at the event. And so we actually got him on the show today. It's wonderful. He has been behind 16 of the VeggieTale movies. He was a producer on those. He's worked on 3-2-1 Penguins. And most recently, he's the showrunner behind the Wingfeather Saga on Angel Studios. If you haven't seen it, it is fantastic. It is independent and it is making waves. So is there anything you'd like to add to that, Chris?
Oh, no. Thanks, Scott. Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. For the panel, our topic of discussion was showmakers, about the ins and outs of getting a show from we want to make this show to the final product, and it's delivered and it's out to the audience, and you get to see the audience reactions and hopefully make money from it. So, yeah, I remember our first topic of discussion that we decided on as a group was that there were three things that you can want, but you can only get two of them, and they're a good price, speed, and quality, right? And everybody had a different emphasis, and I remember your emphasis was time and how you're always trying to structure time in. I'd like to just have you start talking about that. Let's speak about why time is your emphasis.
Absolutely. My caveat right away, Scott, is this is from my own journey. So like, I think everybody out there that's creating, you're going to have your own thing that you're able to focus on. But yeah, in the old triad of good, fast, cheap, choose two. What I had seen over the years in the wonderful craft of animation is that time is just such a wonderful gift, right? Mm-hmm. That the more time you can consider your choices creatively, and sometimes I suppose it can be a burden because you overthink and you just keep going back.
Yes.
But generally, you know, it gives you time to really distill down to what the best parts of any given story are, right? And so we wanted to find a way, as we were setting up for Wingfeather, after, you know, kind of the different shows I'd experienced, was like, okay, at our advantage is time. So how can we get time, you know, and achieve, you know, a high quality, you know, get something we would all be proud of. So time was a quotient that I felt like we could adjust the most, which meant you either spend a lot of money short or you spend, you know, that same amount of money with a smaller team over a longer time. And so we favored the longer time piece. And that was a really important decision to make, right? To say, okay, how can we build that team efficiently and so forth? And there's always a sliding scale when you're building out a production of those two lines, because you can, your overhead can get so expensive that there's a happy medium of what your pace can be, because yeah, you can keep too much too long and so forth. So, but yeah, for us, and for me personally, I'm not the fastest to a creative take. I tend to need to sit with something and find what's the emotionally most resonant piece of it. It takes me a bit to get there. I love finding that, but it mm-hmm. takes a bit to find it sometimes especially in a multi-season, you know, animated series like we've got with Wingfeather, where we're trying to tell a long arc over 7 seasons, you right. know, that the choices you make at the foundation in season 1 to set up what we do, those all matter. And so I tend to want to sit with those longer, you know?
Yeah. I think anybody who's really doing the work and putting in the time, it's the time. It really does take time to really get to the right thing. You know, I have a scene in a current project that I have rewritten, you know, at least 20 times, I think.
That's right.
And it's kind of, it feels agonizing sometimes if you don't have enough time, you know, yep. you like have a deadline and you're trying to get it by that. But it's a good thing to go through. I think it's a good exercise. Speaking of agony, let's talk about your hardest experiences that you've had getting Wingfeather Saga onto the ground, especially since that's your newest project and it's very inspiring.
No, thanks, Ben. Yeah, that's a 6-year overnight success. At the beginning of the process, someone told me, they said, you know, these kind of projects can, you know, take you 3 to 5 years to get set up. And I was like, what? No way. This was quite a journey. I think that anytime that you are trying to create a story in a new space, right? Where you're trying to tell a kind of story in a space that maybe hasn't been done. You have to kind of gird yourself up for it. It's not going to be, it's not on trend. It won't be accepted. It's not currently in vogue, whatever that is. Yeah. So I've had the opportunity to go to Kid Screen. It's this kind of marketplace. And they have an annual convention, typically in Miami, though they're moving next year. And sitting in these sessions with all these outlets, right? So from HBO Max to Apple to Netflix to PBS, they're all, you get to sit in these little sessions and they tell you, here's what we're buying, right?
Yeah.
And over the years, it changes, right? It's all about talking animals. Nope, now we want to do trucks. Now we want to do, we're dead on princesses, but we really want you. And they've said it very openly, like, if you're ever trying to develop a story for what's currently on television or on streaming, whatever, you're about 3 years behind.
Yes.
Right. And yeah. So that it was very heartening for me. I was like, okay, good. Cause a lot of the what I was excited about with Wingfeather wasn't out in the marketplace. Like, it wasn't like, oh, it's just like so-and-so. Now we were very inspired by Avatar Airbender, but that's an old show now. And Dragon Prince kind of went in the same territory. So finding that space for us was the most challenging, because you do feel this sense of, I've got a fan base in our case who had read these novels,
yeah,
and they're very successful, you know, sold over a million copies of it. Like, so we know that and I knew from my own personal experience, it's a great story. But you know, it just hadn't had that pop out there. And it is funny. I was talking to, I worked for a gentleman named Chris Cuser at DreamWorks, while I was there, and he said, yeah, the trouble with Wingfeather, Chris, is you don't have that pop. You don't have that quick sell. And he talked about monsters versus aliens, right? It's like, it's all in the title.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. You can sell the title says everything. Right? Yeah.
It's like done. And he said that the struggle for him in developing How to Train Your Dragon is, you know, riding and training dragons is not an aspirational thought for a lot of kids. It was a really uphill battle for them to get that one made. And he said, I think Wingfeather's in a similar territory. And this is way at the early parts of this, back in 2015, when I first left DreamWorks. And he's like, you know, I think you're going to struggle to kind of get it there. He said, but I believe you've got a story that's going to deliver for the audience when you get the audience in there. And he said, in their case, Monsters vs. Aliens opening weekend was huge, you know, and a year later, I think it was a year later, but How to Train Your Dragon opening weekend was soft. But they knew that they could deliver on audience experience. And so How to Train Your Dragon had legs, you know, on that, right?
Yeah.
Just went for days.
Yeah.
And he said, it's you're going to have a similar challenge with Wingfeather. And he's not, but that was so accurate, you know, 6 years before we got into it. And I think that there's something interesting about the kind of stories that maybe, you know, people in your audience are excited about, right? That they go, oh, my favorite of all time is this, right? And you have to think about, okay, look at that thing. Did it have immediate success when it came out in the market? How long did the storyteller have to work to get it out there? You know, we all talk about Miyazaki and how popular that is, but in the United States, not as popular, right?
Right,
as some of the bigger, faster stuff that's out there.
Well, he even just released a film without marketing, and it was a smash hit,
right?
You know,
yeah.
But
and because he's developed this niche audience who supports him, right?
Yep. Yep.
Broadly, you know, but. Your average audience in Omaha may not show up for it, right? And I think it's just knowing where your story is going to land and being willing to put up with all the stuff that's going to come in between that. And so for us, there was a lot of discouragement along the way, right? There was like upsides. We did a Kickstarter in 2016, had immediate success. We were trying to raise $100,000 to do a little short film, and we raised $265,000. It was like, oh my gosh, like this is awesome. Made this great short film to high acclaim, showed it to every studio. I remember being at Paramount and they were totally into it. Murray had produced the Madagascar series. And so we knew her. And so showed it to her and she's like, oh, this is fantastic, but it's not really Nickelodeon Paramount, you know, vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just saw Ninja Turtles and I was like, yeah, but the style works, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, we had these high levels of like, oh, this is totally, we felt so confident about the short film. And then it just, nothing happened. It just sat, you know, and end of 2020.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. At the end of 2020, I sat down with Andrew, who's the author and my co-EP. And I think I'm done. I think I've tried my hardest to get this project off the ground and I just can't get it. And I believe in it, but you probably need somebody else to take it because I've tried every door I can try. And it was in that low of, and frankly, it was a bit of a faith walk for me.
You know,
I, I've openly, you know, put this before God and said, hey, what journey am I supposed to be on as a creator? You know, I want to create, I love awesome adventure shows. And, but if this show's not for me, I'll go make something else, you know? And I kind of got to that low at the end of 2020. I was like, well, I made my journey and I'll just go knock on the door and get another job doing something else. Right. Mm-hmm. And then it was the beginning of 21 that we had had some conversations with Angel Studios that they reached out and said, hey, we, you know, have spent some time digging deep on Wingfeather and we want this to be our next show, a narrative That's show amazing. After Chosen. Like, oh my gosh, you believe in it? Yeah, we believe in it. We think it can go. And so we began that journey. And so it's an interesting journey from highs and lows, you know, and those Andrew came over one night after we got our second decline from Netflix and brought over some ice cream. And we sat around and commiserated and like, well, Netflix said no again. Now what do we do? And it was interesting to think that had they said yes, it would have been kind of a bum deal, you know, because
you wouldn't have had the same kind of amazing deal.
and so much of that creative gets absconded and just things that we wouldn't have been able to really enjoy now. And this relationship we have with our fans, you know, I think one of the things that's been cool about our journey is this really wonderful relationship with the fans, both through the novels and then now through the TV series.
Yeah.
And we're now second gen, right? So a lot of those fans who were kids when they first read the books are now in their 20s.
Yeah.
You know,
that's cool.
Yeah. And so it's, and I'm one of those guys, right? I read it to my kids and was like, oh, I love this book series. And so to be a part of make it now.
That's so amazing. You know, Angel Studios is interesting in that way. I've noticed that every big project that has been such a smash success with them has had a story like this where, you know, it's like the end of the rope type of thing. And actually I just submitted something to the guild, right? A month ago. And I was pretty foolish to think because everybody was so excited about it. And I had nearly gotten the film funded before. And like, there's just all this buzz. And all of a sudden I had to change my torch last minute because they didn't want the filmmaker in it. And all of a sudden the animatic alone just wasn't ready yet. I was only on like, you know, 2 of 5 of the storyboard versions that Pixar and, you know, Secret of Gel's Cartoon Saloon does, you know, so it just wasn't quite ready. But going through and listening to Dallas Jenkins' story about his big flop, you know, but how he just continued forward, you know, and went on a faith journey. It was very prayerful and got certain answers that really resonated with me. And then your story and Tuttle Twins had a similar thing where they started the crowdfunding because they didn't have the guild back then. And it wasn't crowdfunding. And they had to add 1 minute to the beginning of the torch and suddenly it worked, you know?
Yeah.
So
well, it's interesting on that. I think that, you know, as a showrunner, you have to be someone who's in control of your story. You know, so the term showrunner, for those that don't know this, was a developed term from network television, which was they would get a pitch from someone. I want to make a show about a thing. And they would go, oh, we like that. We're going to buy that show. And they'd send them off with some money. They'd go make it and it'd come back. And sometimes the show would be different. And they wait, who did that? And one of the producers, oh, it's not me. I'm the money guy. I'm this guy. And they're like, who's in charge here? You know, because there's like 6 producers, right? Or EPs, whatever. And so the networks derive this term showrunner. There's going to be somebody
who runs that show forward. Yeah.
I said, I wanted a chicken sandwich. You're going to give me a chicken sandwich, right? Don't show up with sort of brisket, you know? And so that is, so you have to be in control of your story, not only narratively and being that coach, it's in there, like working with your writers, working with your directors to get that all the software, but all the way through from the design elements through sound design and all the way to the finished package, that this was the thing that either the network executives or in our case, the audience asked for.
Yeah.
And am I delivering on that place? I would tell you that I thought in 2016, as we were taking this out to really start pitching hard, actually it was 2015 that we had our first rounds of meetings with Netflix and others and Amazon.
Yeah.
I would have told you then I thought I knew exactly what the story was. Okay. I knew what the story was, but I didn't know what it needed to be as a TV series.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. I knew. And so if you put me in an elevator for a pitch, I could probably get through it, but it wasn't to its best version of itself that would have commercial viability. Right. Or at least a connection with an audience. It wasn't there yet. And we had this somewhat infamous pitch meeting at Amazon in which I had Tom Owens, who had a story on How to Turn Your Dragon 2 and just brilliant story guy that I'd worked a long time directing our short, and Andrew, the author of the series, right? So I just walked in rolling and said, and so the Amazon guy, great guy, he said, all right, so tell me about Wingfeather Saga. And I'm like, fantastic, Andrew. And he went and he literally just kind of went, Well, it's about because in his head is the entire four book novel scope.
I know. Like,
Not everything at once. How long do you have? Right. And I was like, oh, no. And we had rehearsed, to be clear. Like, we weren't like we didn't know what we were doing. But it just went. We didn't really have a handle on how to really tell someone about what the story was that they needed to go get invested. You've got to have that shorthand. You may not have monsters versus aliens, but you got to have some version of a pitch that helps you. You know, how do you sell How to Train Your Dragon? Get it down to its essence. And so we came out of that meeting and Andrew's like, man, I wish I could have done that again. Also, I'm never doing that again. And he was like, I'm not going to pitch meetings anymore. I don't want to do it. It's in my head. And but over the refining years, so by the time we were ready to come to market in 21 and do this crowdfunding and do this big, we knew what our story was then, right? Mm-hmm. I knew like, here's what I'm going to try to get out to the market. And so we were able to cut through and own a space and just all those things that we honestly weren't ready for.
It has to go through a process, you know, of pitching and failing.
It's not the materials changing all that much. Not like you're saying, oh, it's not this kind of character. It's not that much change. It's just adjustments.
And the way you describe it. Yeah. That's awesome.
So, yeah, our journey, you know, obviously went through those highs and lows, but and continues to have that. I mean, you know, season one is out there. We're so thrilled that it got out. We want to grow that audience and get them ready for season two, continue to build that expectation and excitement about the story we're telling. You know, I'm in a position now of listening to a lot of what people have experienced in season one and trying to take the best versions of that into what we're doing then in season two. And, you know, it's been fun. And it's also, I think, knowing who your audience is, like who are the ones who are into it and the ones who are out. I'm good. You were never with me anyways. You know, it's like, I'm not going to fight for that audience because we're just not their story, you know, and that's okay.
Well, the interesting thing about that too, is I feel like there's an opportunity to win them later, you know, where.
Totally. Yeah. And they come back around. Right.
I've seen that many times where people are like, that's not for me. But then somebody else is like, you really should check it out. And they're like, okay, I'll check it. I think that happened with me with The Chosen. I saw somebody watching it.
Into something and you're like, yeah, sure. It happened to me with Avatar Airbender. I tried to watch that show over and over, and I'd get a couple episodes in. I'm like, I don't get it. I don't see it. And then I finally was like, okay, I got it. And then you got to get over. There's a certain trigger. And then it's like, oh, I'm in, you know, I had that happen with Andor, the Star Wars thing. You know, my kids were like, oh, it's awesome, Dad. You got to watch it. And I like first couple episodes, I'm like, what am I watching here? I don't get it, you know, and then it flips over and you're like, oh, and I think it's an interesting appetite that people have changed, right? And kind of the viewership that it's, if it doesn't get you in the first episode, that's okay. I'm going to stay with it. We're kind of learning to stay with stuff a little longer.
Yeah.
And give it a chance. Then you hear all the acclaim, like, oh my gosh, that series is so great. And like, I didn't love it, but I'll try it again. You know?
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Awesome. So how does the future of your project look? It sounds like it's looking good.
Yeah. So, one of the things, you know, we decided at the front end was multidimensional. We wanted to step into a market that hadn't been served by this kind of story. You know, you talk about what's the open water, where's the place where there's not activity. For us, it was coming off of years of VeggieTales, right? Which was fairly overt, right? Where a lot of Bible stories and this kind of thing, like it's if not moral lessons, biblical lessons, you know, this kind of thing, but mostly just entertaining characters and stories. I was interested in this middle space, we call it, right? Where it's stories that are deeply true, that resonate with us. Avatar Airbender resonated so hard.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's true, right? It's deeply true. Harry Potter is that same thing where there's these stories that just pin to things that are just humankind shares. Barbie movie's doing that right now, right? And I wanted to be a part of a story like that. So not overt. So for a Christian audience, they're not going to pick up on some sort of like evangelical gospel presentation. Like I wasn't interested in that, right? Which there's a whole marketplace that does that. And certainly my VeggieTales affiliation kind of had some pulls towards that side. But I also wasn't interested in just secular, where it's like nobody knows what true is and we don't know how to pin our story down to anything that's deeply true about the human experience. I didn't want that side either.
Yeah.
But in this middle space is complicated, because what I found with Wingfeather in particular was that the Christian side of the marketplace was like, yeah, we're dead on it because it's got fantasy and I think there's dragons in it and those are from the devil. And I was like, whoa. And they wouldn't touch it as though, you know, Tolkien and Lewis had never written, you know, Lord of the Rings and Narnia. Like, wait, read those stories? Like, so the other side of it is, on the secular side, they were like suspicious of the kind of spiritual elements in it, you know? And we were like, no, we're not, like, it's, so we found ourselves in a little space where it's like, no, I want to make something that resonates, but welcomes all viewers to just engage in it, you know?
Yeah. That's the kind of work I want to do for sure.
Yeah.
And it is a tough place to be.
It's a tough place to be, because you get protests on both sides, you know? And so anyways, I think that was a big part of our journey. And what I wanted to do too was to fill that middle space on story. And then I wanted to find a way to, as a craft, bring something special. I was very tired of the cheaper version of, right? Mm-hmm. That's where, if you love this, you'll love this cheaper version of whatever show that is on the, you know, Pixar on the cheap kind of thing. And so much of CG animation is that way. And I love 2D animation, but the North American appetite for 2D is just not there. And so you're like, okay, what can I do in CG? They want that. So that was the Kickstarter, was kind of born out of that, was, can we prove a production path that can bring something that has a high visual craft, but is at a more competitive budget, mm-hmm. right? That led to this kind of CG 2D hybrid, which at the time we were exploring this in 2016 and 17 was questionable. And even as we took the short film we'd created, which is very much like the series, had all the outlets say, we love this, but you know, the audience really wants that Pixar look. And I was like, man, I think there's a CG glut. There is a tiring of the modeling clay on a partly cloudy day. And so could you try something else? And thankfully, of course, in 2018, Spider-Verse came out and kind of, you know, bumped the jukebox, and everybody said, oh, we want non-traditional CGI. So it was suddenly kind of in the moment, right? It's like, oh, good. Okay. Thank you. And let's go try some stuff.
Yeah.
And so anyways, but that has a specific cost advantage. So it was also saying, can I play in this sandbox, right? And mm-hmm. make something that's visually rich and interesting. And we had, over the years, at the various studios that our leadership team had been at, you know, had gotten the art of books, you know, those just beautiful. And we were so many of those. You've got a lovely set behind you. We would look at those and go, man, wouldn't it have been cool if this art was on screen, right? If it hadn't had to go through the CGI sanitation, if it's just like, that would be so amazing. And so a lot of our desire was, what could we do to get the artists taking their actual work and putting it out to screen? And that was really kind of the drive there. And so that gave us kind of a production craft. It's like, okay, we're not going to do it in traditional whatever style, and we're going to have a story that is in the same space, right? That is being produced differently. And so, to my great delight, the end result of that being that we actually got to create our own art of book.
What? What?
Like, television series like ours don't get to do this, but thanks to Angel and all that kind of stuff, we got to make an art of book ourselves.
And it's available somewhere?
That has all the cool stuff, right? And it's a big, hefty, and it's like,
oh yeah, I want that.
and it's taking, what's fun in our show is, of course, it's taking all this artwork that is, you know, just so beautiful, that is actually in the show, you know, just, yeah. It just kind of turns off the character layer and there it is, you know, and has, you know, design process, all that kind of fun stuff. So yeah, so this comes out later this year, but
oh,
the turnaround for me of like having been inspired by art of books and then being able to actually make one, you know,
I've kind of gotten all the art books I want is how I feel when all these art books come out, but that's what I want. So I'll be looking forward to that. That sounds great.
Yeah. I'll make sure you know about it. I know a guy.
I think you do.
Yeah. And then the other strategy for us too was, if we're going to do that, we're going to do it with different technology. And so at the very beginning of this production, we had done some testing in Unreal Engine, saw it as a real game changer in what you could do in CG animation. And so we actually ported our whole shader system that we'd built in Maya for the short film and got it over into a blueprint in UE, and have now built an entire animation studio. So normally in our situation, of course, you would farm out to a production studio in Vancouver or elsewhere. And that was most of my career with Veggie. We just did that.
Yeah.
This was, what if we use this tool, Unreal Engine, in this way, but using it in a very different way than it's intended. So we had kind of issued the photo reel, like we're not interested in photo reel. And so it was like, okay, what could we do in Unreal Engine to make it feel handcrafted and painterly, you know,
yeah.
And kind of break. And what that meant is we have a wonderful, you know, kind of our senior leadership team that's 20 plus years, you know, of doing stuff in animation from all kinds of big studios. And then a very young staff, which has been delightful, that are either fresh out of college, you know, or otherwise, who have learned a variety of animation and CG skills that we can bend towards the way we're using them, right? And they're all multidisciplinarians who, you know, can do Blender, can also go over here and work in Unreal, can, you know, just bounce around. And it's been just amazing. And then our team is, you know, thanks, one of the results of COVID obviously was that we all got to find out how to work remotely better in animation. And so we can tap into artists all over the world, you know, and have been able to. And so our crew of 70, 75 people, you know, we're based in Nashville, Tennessee, our studio, but we're kind of all over the place and get to do, you know, connections like this and make a show, you know. Yeah. So like I said, one, we got to make this way, and now banging away on season two.
That's wonderful. I'd love to hear you speak more to that idea of finding people. It seems like it's really a big challenge.
Well, the thing that and it's very competitive. You know, there's a lot of animation in production, you know, and it had a dip earlier this year, but it seems to be coming back. There, you know, the quality of your show, because if you're making a show that's interesting and compelling, artists are more inclined to come to
us. Yes.
If you're making a show that maybe is not as compelling, and that can be whatever. I mean, honestly, there's people that love to work in shows that are preschool driven. Like, it's not that it's only all Arcane, right? Because not everybody's into that. It's it's every kind of show. But is your show good? And if you can win the artist who wants to work on a show, you've really proven out for yourself your first litmus, you know, because if your crew's working on it just because they need a job and getting paid, it's like, maybe my show's not that good.
Yep. That's absolutely true. Yeah. I've noticed at Steamroller, we have multiple shows going on, but we have one that is the Steamroller production, and everybody wants to be on that one, you know, and it's cool.
Yeah. Sure. There's always that. Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah. And working on that one's interesting. There's a very high quality demand. It's going to be a great production whenever it comes out. So Spice Frontier, it is announced. So whenever you get to see it, there's a short available on steamrollerstudios.com. And then for anybody listening, the episodes will be longer than that, but it's going to be great. So, yeah. What's your approach to finding people then? Like,
So it is relational. You know, the animation industry is very small, you know, and so it ends up being a lot of connections to people, right? And then of course you do the LinkedIn posts and so forth and see who rallies around. And it's kind of like, you know, you set up a little fire and say, hey, who's into this?
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
No, and if you're into it, then we're all into it, you know, and you kind of need those flares. And then it's just kind of finding the right people. One of the things that we had found in the animation industry is that especially the studios, it drives towards cogs, right? Where it's, I need a single disciplinarian who's really good at one thing and do that for the entire production run. Mm-hmm. And which is great. I mean, it's very useful in those large systems. And if you raise your hand and say, I do a different thing, they're like, don't care. You do the one thing for us. We spin the other way, right? We're looking at people who are alive, alert, awake, enthusiastic, and willing to put on multiple hats. Mm-hmm. And what that means for us is I can have longer engagement with those folks because they start one phase of our production and can transition to a second phase and then even to a third phase.
That's awesome.
Because of their varied skill sets. And it also keeps them loose and keeps them fresh, right?
Yeah.
So we look for people who are that, who are curious. And so finding those people is really the thing. We're a small studio as an independent. And so we're looking for people who are problem solvers and who are looking to, how can I contribute value? How can I solve this problem outside of my own desk, you know?
Yeah.
And I would say that extends, you know, for me as a showrunner, that extends to all parts, including the writers, right? And I mentioned this to you when we spoke earlier, but my journey through to showrunner was one that did not come through the writer's room.
Yeah.
I don't like screenwriting myself. I love story development and characters and that, but I don't like my own writing. I don't like dialogue. It's not my thing. And it honestly was quite a mental block for me for many years of, well, I'll never be a showrunner, right? Or in that seat. And then I came to find there were other showrunners who were coming from the same place, who had a great writing team, a really good story editor, people that they could work with to partner.
Yep.
And I got to develop and produce another kid series called The Slugs and Bugs Show. It was a puppet show, kind of a Mr. Rogers meets Sesame Street. And it's super fun. Mm-hmm. 26 episodes of this. And it was whole cloth out of my head, pitch a show and a little network picked it up and we went and made the darn thing. And it was super fun. And thankfully I got to kind of exercise that muscle ahead of getting into Wingfeather in its full tilt. And in that, you know, you develop those relationships with those writers who also are helping you solve problems across mm-hmm. multiverse, if you will.
Yeah.
If this happens here, how do we tie it to this happening here? And you know, it's a bit unwieldy. We just had our writer's room for season three a few weeks ago, and we had to build out a huge timeline on the wall to try to keep ourselves straight, not only within a continual season in your ABC. I think we even had a D storyline. You know, it's like all these characters keeping track and making sure that it doesn't, you know, you're not colliding against something you set up in season one or two, as you whatever. So yeah. it's a lot, right? And,
it is.
And you
it's
need
incredible.
Writers who are engaged in the whole thing mm-hmm. and able to really kind of take it all in. Yes, the story lives in my head, and I have to be the one to help keep it aligned, you know, mm-hmm. so that we don't suddenly veer off and, you know, but also allow the freedom for everybody to keep contributing and adding to it, you know.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, one reason I created this show was to find a producer. And it's mm-hmm. been an interesting journey. We're going to be at episode 50 next month. And wow. Yeah, we're releasing 5 more pitches. So it'll be 15 pitches total for feature films. But I keep finding producers who I think, oh, this is the right fit. This is going to be great. And then they get too busy. And then I keep finding a producer who gets too busy, which is interesting. Like you said, the competition is a very interesting dynamic. So what would you say to something like that as a producer, like who's looking, well, you're not looking for projects, but you have been in the past?
Well, and again, I think that, you know, from, again, my seat of showrunner. Okay. Mm-hmm. So from my seat, it is one of, I need to find people who can complement the skills that I don't have.
Yes.
I've got to grow in skills that I have that are nascent. I'm not much of an entrepreneur. It's funny, after the 10 plus years of VeggieTales, you know, 16 movies and with DreamWorks and so forth, when I stepped out of that building, friends and colleagues in this market were like, oh man, well, you're set for success, man, because you've had that. And actually I was like infantile. Like I didn't know what to do because I hadn't worked the independent field.
Yep.
And the entrepreneur parts of setting up a production. For me, it was convincing other executives the value of a story and what it needed to be and pitching internally. That's just a different set of concerns than out to the open marketplace. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't ready for it. And I realized quickly, okay, I need people that complement my skills in different areas, right? And then it's just about cold calling, you know, and saying, hey, so-and-so, do you want to work on this with me? You know, and it's relational. You have some connection to people. And could you make an introduction for me to so-and-so? Because I want to, you know, bring them into this and so forth. I had learned early on in my career that the more that you are just able to be relationally authentic and winsome, you can go a lot for it, you know, and versus you've got to join me because this is the best thing ever. And you know, kind of salesman, and maybe it's a little bit inauthentic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, sure, some people make that work for them. But for me, it was just being totally myself, but being somebody who could own a decision and carry it out. Right. I think that I had gained a reputation in my career as a producer, as a closer, that at the end of the day, the project gets done and it's ready for market. And, you know, I have a grit and endurance. Mm-hmm. They talk a lot about what does it take to be successful in, you know, kind of business and other endeavors. And I think it works in creative endeavors too.
It does.
And grit is this ineffable thing, which is this stick-to-itness, this like, I'm going to stay, I'll be the last one off that field. You know, we're going to go until it can't go anymore. That was something that I stubbornly had. And it's benefited me greatly in my journey because I didn't have the kind of wow creative talents that people would be like, whoa, his writing is amazing or his directing is outstanding. I didn't have any of that stuff, but I knew I'd come up through editorial and was a DP for a number of years and kind of had opportunity to have experience in lots of different disciplines. And so what I found late, because I didn't start producing until 2006 or so, what I found then was, oh, I can speak intelligently to all these different disciplines mm-hmm. in a way that's pathetic, where like, I understand the workload. I'm not as skilled as you are, but I understand the workload that you must endure. How can I best resource you to achieve what you can do in the best way? Right.
Right.
And that really became an understanding for me of producer and then showrunner is like, how can I serve all of you with clear coaching direction, you know, on what we're trying to accomplish here together. And how can I also remain humble and take your inputs? So as you see something differently and say, oh, well, could it be like this?
Not leadership.
Siloed, like, you know, it's gotta be my way. I think I told you this story before, but we had this one experience with Chris Kuser, again, a development exec. He's still at DreamWorks, just did Puss in Boots too. Just brilliant. He, one day we were meeting with a writer and we'd given this writer a bunch of feedback on an outline. Well, half hour meeting, whatever. The guy leaves. And as the door closes, Chris says, I'm never working with that jerk again.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
I was like, what? But that was a great meeting. He's like, did you hear him? He said yes to every idea I gave him. Every one of our notes, he just said yes. He doesn't know what the story is. He doesn't know what he wants. He didn't have any skin in the game, right? He actually wasn't. He hired writer. And I was like, oh, and he said, you have to serve creative responsibly. He said, on a team, and he said, in animation, it's particularly this way. On a team, each of us have responsibilities to that bit of creative, right? Each of us have something we owe to it to keep it alive, right? It's if the creative lives out here and we each have a duty to it, right? Okay. If any one of us then takes and makes it, the thing gets really messed up. Right. And so everything I say is personal, right? Your baby's a little bit ugly. How dare you?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, we got a problem. Nor do we want it fawning, right? Where everything you say is perfect. It's wonderful. That's not true. And Chris had learned in his career, he said, I may put forward, 20 ideas, and maybe one of them is worth even thinking about to find its best version of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
many of them are just not great. They're fresh because they just came out of your mouth, mm-hmm. and they're interesting. But they're not necessarily the ones you should pursue. And I think early in his career, he had some of that as an executive, kind of pushed to get things to happen, saw the execution, realized, what did I fight for? Because the same is true where you find a creative like a writer who falls under a sword for every single thing.
Yeah.
And they just can't really work with them, right?
No.
And
no.
So the yes man and the fall on your sword anywhere creatively is a problem. And you have to find people who are mature, responsible creatives who can love the thing they love, fight for the things that are right to fight for, and be willing to find another version of, right?
Yeah.
And mature. And then a showrunner, I think my responsibility is to hold that intention.
Yeah.
Sometimes the changes that my directors or an editor might push for are changes they want because it's different, not better, just different.
Right.
And recognizing the separation between, is this actually better?
Yeah, that is a challenge.
Does it feel
it's
fresh?
Because
I've been sitting with this other version for 6 months and I'm tired of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. You have to remember that you're not the audience seeing it for the first time, So I've heard of one of my favorite writers, Brian McDonald. He's been in writing rooms where they just want to cut the whole first act. And he's like, whoa, the audience needs that. They're like, well, we don't feel like we need it anymore. Well, that's because you've seen
it before.
You
don't feel that way anymore. Yeah. You've been too close for too long. And that's the great value of test audiences and mm-hmm. people that are outside the process. I have to work really hard with our team here to try to create that strata. Mm-hmm. That I'm down here in the sausage, man. We are every day aware of all the thousands of decisions made, but we work even as a small team here. We work really hard to keep some separation. Mm-hmm. So, like in our department, I don't want to. In fact, on our Slack channels, I uninvite myself all the time to Slack channels because I don't want to know all the chatter.
Yeah,
I want to see a version of it and be able to objectively look at that and not know all that went into it. This is the argument about editors, whether in live action, whether an editor should be on set, and cutting and aware of what's being captured, or back home, getting it in the mail and cold to what it took to get those things. Right. Mm-hmm. And out of that, I'm cold. I want to be cold to it. I want to look at a piece of art. I want to look at a piece at a animatic cold as much as I can so I can get that fresh take. Right. And go, what do I feel about it right now? If I know the thousands of decisions it took to get there, I've lost something, And then we do the same thing with Andrew, my co-EP and the author. He sits outside one rung past. So I get like five iterations and he'll get one, right? To kind of keep his eyes fresh, because then he'll come in and be the stink bomb. If kind of coming from that side, guys, you missed it. You forgot this and this. And, oh, shoot, because we're too close to it.
Yeah.
That's another discipline I would say for any small independent team is creating safe barriers where you can have those objective perspectives, right? And it's one of the things that the big studios do very well, mm-hmm. right? They build up to these kind of monumental. John Lasseter's coming in. I was talking to my friend who was at Pixar for years, and we got a JL meeting coming in. Everybody builds up to this moment. Well, there's something about that creative discipline that's actually quite healthy, right?
Yeah.
To build a moment of outside review and then get that review and then decide how to then best execute. Definitely. I will say that too. One of the things I had to learn as a showrunner is then how to best execute once feedback is received, because it may not be the most obvious.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Very true.
I didn't laugh at this. So on one hand, therefore cut it. Hang on. Maybe we just need to tune it. Maybe it's just not tuned.
Yeah.
Right. Unless you
know, maybe it wasn't meant for left too. That could be it too.
It may not have been for left too. Totally. Yeah. I was talking to a colleague that produced the original Dumb and Dumber. Talked about their first screening went terrible. The movie was not funny. The audience didn't get it. They didn't laugh. And he had a fight with the other producer, the money guy, like pushed him up against the wall. And it was a really bad deal. It was like, wow, this movie is terrible. What did you do? And he's like, hey, it was our first screening. We'll get there, you know? And of course they did.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Obviously. Because
in entertainment, I mean, the difference between that scene worked and it didn't can often be just a little something. It can be score. It's just, I need a little more moment here. You know, it who knows, but what you want to have is a mature view of that. You know, don't just cut it and throw it away. It's like, well, maybe it was going to work, but we just missed the beat. It's, you know, I love watching Comedians in Cars, the Jerry Seinfeld show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hearing comics have to work routines, and that same joke did not work over and over. It didn't work. And then they finally figured it out. And now it's a killer joke, right?
Yeah.
Same material, same thing. You just got to find it. And I think in entertainment, so much of that discipline, that's why the time is valuable for me.
Yeah.
Is so much of that time you need to find the best version. Like, what's the one that's really going to work? I just had an edit session.
This whole conversation came full circle. I love that.
I had a session with my editor before I came in here that was tuning a moment, right? Mm-hmm. That it was actually, we're done with animation in this one episode. And it was, hey, something's not working. Let's work the scene a bit, you know? And
that's brilliant. I love that.
Right. You know?
Yeah. And I think the most encouraging thing you said was this idea that you're a finisher, you know? That's very encouraging for me to hear, because that's what I've tried to establish over and over again. We got, you know, Kickstarter 1, this is Kickstarter 3, so Cirque du Solitude. Kickstarter 2 failed, and I ended up getting a grant somewhere else and finishing the short film. And then Kickstarter 4, you know, is Mass Magic. And each one of these is like, I'm delivering you a story with visuals that could be made into a film. Here's the feature film pitch. I've pitched it at different studios, you know, just over and over doing that process. I think that not only helps other people, it helps you. It helps you to be confident to go, I know we just got out of the screening, it went badly, but I know how to tune the moments. I know how, you know, that's
very encouraging. Or even if you don't, it's that you have some people you could call.
That's
right.
Yes.
That you have some people that will sit with you and figure it out. Right.
Yeah.
Because you shouldn't feel the pressure of like, well, it's all on me.
You shouldn't have to do it all by yourself. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That like, I've got some people who will help me to figure out how we get there. You know?
Yeah. I love that. So we're up to the end of the live cast. Usually the question we ask is the Get Wiser moment. It's a question you've already actually started to answer. So that is that if my goal is to get the highest clarity of truth into a story, what approach would you recommend?
Andrew tells this quote. We don't know. It's been sourced by a couple of people, and I'll probably mangle it even telling it here. But this idea of, if you want someone to know the truth, tell them. If you want someone to love the truth, tell them a story.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it's finding out a way, again, on that winsome side, that to tell what's true about your story, what's true about the experience that you had. You know, this was something that Pixar was so disciplined in, is bring in your firsthand, bring in what's true to you and tell that. Don't do it secondhand. Right. Don't try to tell, I heard this from somebody else. Mm-hmm. It's you firsthand experience. What's true to you, and how can you translate it into a story that makes it experientially true to the next person, right? To your audience. Mm-hmm. In a way that allows for it to be what it's going to be. You know, I live in Nashville, Tennessee, home of the authentic songwriter.
Yep.
And we're known for songwriters who can write out of authenticity. And what many of them carry is a humility to say, here's an experience. I'm going to put it in a song. Now, audience, you tell me what you're experiencing out of this. And the audience will then say back, here's what works for me. Here's what I connect to. Here's what means a lot to me. I think there's as a storyteller, do the best to kind of put out in the world what is true to you, but be willing to let the audience take something that maybe is a little different than what you set up. And they may interpret.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, if you're a dictator with that, you must think and feel about this. You're really making propaganda.
Yeah, it's propaganda. It's a lecture. Yep.
Yeah. And people know that, especially if you're interested in being in children's entertainment. Children are completely aware of that, where this is suddenly moved from being something I'm enjoying the entertainment of to, oh, I'm being educated. You know, I remember in a session at Kids Screen a couple years ago, PBS going, we're dead on edutainment. Nobody does edutainment anymore. Because kids are dead on it.
Yeah.
We do entertainment that is rooted in educational ideals, but you've got to hide that. You got to hide that broccoli deep, you know, because the moment the kids can feel the curriculum, they're dead on you, you know, and then this weird space. And something that we wanted for this series is I wanted the series to be something that a kid would vote for. Increasingly, kids have the remote. They're going to choose what they watch.
Yes.
Mom and dad might aspirationally say, I want them to watch this. We would do these surveys and all this data gathering and studies with parents during the VeggieTales days of what sort of stories are meaningful to you? What do you want us to talk? And then what kind of, you know, and they would give all this aspirational response about, I want broccoli for my kids, right? It's all this stuff. Okay, so what are you at? And then we'd ask them, what are you actually consuming? McDonald's.
I know.
You know, my kids are watching Disney Channel all day long.
Yeah.
But you said you want VeggieTales. I know, but the kids like Disney better. You know, and you're like, okay, well, let's just be honest here with the kind of entertainment that I'm trying to make and know that I'm trying to compete for the kid. I'm trying to compete for the audience that I'm aiming for, not the aspirational audience. Otherwise, I'm just going to only have mom and dad or grandparents saying, you should watch this. The moment it's a you should, eh. You know, I want to earn the I want to watch it because I really like it, right? And not look for a pass just because what I have to say is important, right? Or what I have to say is meaningful or don't do that.
Yeah.
Do it because the characters are interesting and the story is interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned C.S. Lewis early on in the conversation. And, you know, I went to the bookstore the other day, like a few months ago, and I looked at what books were on the shelf and they were new books and C.S. Lewis, you know, and J.R.R. Tolkien, like those stories of Lassen. And I think it's because he was writing a great story first, even the Screwtape Letters that, you know, is so deep with all this stuff that is just so good. Still a story first. And I love that. I think that's brilliant advice. And thank you for being on the show. If anybody wants to follow Chris, I have links in the show notes to the Wingfeather Saga, so you can actually watch it, or to social media and whatnot. And thanks again for coming on, Chris. And until next time, I hope we all get a little wiser.
Thank you for watching the Directing Animation Livecast, hosted by Scott Weiser. Audio version edited by Kira Horowitz. Copyright Scott Weiser, LLC 2023. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube and ring that notification bell.